made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Celeste Quinn. An expert on pediatric sleep is our guest this afternoon. She's here to take your questions and offer advice to help you and your children get a good night's sleep. Our guest is psychologist Dr. Jody Mindell. She is Associate Director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And she's the author of Sleeping Through the Night, How Infants, Toddlers, and Their Parents Can Get a Good Night's Sleep. Listeners, I welcome your questions about sleep for our guest, Jody Mindell. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use our toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Jody Mindell is a professor of psychology at St. Joseph's University and of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. Her research focuses on the assessment and treatment of common sleep problems in children, as well as sleep problems related to pregnancy and parenting. Her book, Sleeping Through the Night, is available in paperback from Harper Resource, an imprint of HarperCollins. It's now out in a revised edition from Harper Resource. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Jody Mindell, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. You know, a note that came with the book from your publisher says that a recent National Sleep Foundation poll found 75% of all parents wanting to change something about their children's sleep habits. It seems to me that a lot of people aren't getting a good night's sleep.
Yeah, isn't that incredible? Yeah, the National Sleep Foundation, and I chaired the poll last year, we polled 1,500 parents and caregivers of children ages 0 to 10, and 74 point whatever percent. So 3 out of 4 parents wanted to change something about their child's sleep. And the other number that was shocking to me was that 69% of parents reported that their child had a sleep problem at least a few nights a week. So again, that's most kids. So parents are not alone out there figuring that their child's the only one not sleeping.
And if the kids aren't sleeping, the parents aren't sleeping either.
Yeah, and it's incredible. And we looked at that relationship between children's sleep and parents' sleep and really saw that when the baby's not sleeping, especially the baby, the adults are up. But even all the way up through the age of 10, you really find it has a huge impact on families. And, you know, and a lot of times I hear from parents all the time, you know, kind of this, you know, guilt and we should be completely sacrificing for our children and sort of saying, I don't want to let him cry at my 9-month-old in the middle of the night because, you know, I'm really sort of doing this for me to get a good night's sleep. And I think it's really important for parents to realize that you're really doing it for your child first and you're still secondary in a couple of ways. One is a baby who's waking up 3 times a night feels just as terrible the next day as an adult does. And the second thing is that having a parent who's awake and alert and happy to see you in the morning is also really critical to having a really good life and having a parent that can do the job they need to do for you.
Yeah. Are the sleep problems of adults and young children the same?
You know, they're quite different, and in a lot of different ways. One is that, babies very often have poor habits have developed. Those habits, though, are quite different than the poor habits that adults develop. So a baby may be, you know, sucking on a bottle to fall asleep or being rocked asleep, where an adult may have the television on to fall asleep. Again, another bad habit. There's also a lot of sleep disorders that are quite different. Sleep apnea, which is a breathing problem, is quite different in young children versus adults. Even things like insomnia, what we think of as difficulty falling asleep, usually for quite different reasons when you compare, say, an 8-year-old and you compare a 45-year-old.
Sleep apnea in young children, that's got to be fairly rare, I hope.
It's about, not as rare as you think, it's about 2 to 3% of all children, which to us is a pretty high number. And in children, it peaks between the ages of 3 and 6, so preschoolers are much more likely to have sleep apnea than any other child age group. And the reason for sleep apnea in children is mostly because they have large tonsils and adenoids. So they have these very large tonsils and adenoids that shrink as they get older, but at the same time that they have these little teeny airways. So they have these big things in this small space. And it makes it so that when their muscles relax and they fall asleep, breathing stops. And for, I'd say, 80 to 90% of those children, they take the tonsils and adenoids out, and the kids do great. But we don't think of it as, we think of it as this middle-aged, right, overweight male, kind of the John Belushi, John Candy body type. But you really see it in these little ones, and a lot of them are little skinny minis because they either have some hard time eating because those tonsils are in the way, or their metabolism is working so hard at night that they also are skinny.
So a sleep problem or a sleep disorder can be a medical problem.
Right. And, in our sleep center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, we're multidisciplinary. It's one of the few in the country that's multidisciplinary, where we have the behavioral issues, we have the medical issues, and we have a team of pulmonary and neurology and psychology and psychiatry, and it's really nice we can span it. Things like narcolepsy, which is a medical disorder, sleep apnea, sleepwalking, we sort of don't know which side of the line that falls on. So, yeah, there's a whole wide range of sleep problems in children.
Yeah. Now, what's the difference between a problem and a disorder?
Oh, that's the million-dollar question. You know what? There really is no answer. There's no real line that it crosses over. A disorder means I can probably find a diagnosis in a book, and a problem means it's causing some difficulties for people. But, that distinction probably is fairly meaningless other than sort of the semantics of the words, because parents ask that all the time, and we don't have a good answer. So sometimes we use sleep problems, sometimes we say sleep disturbance, sometimes we say sleep disorder. Just sort of depends on our mood.
Well, then when do you seek out the assistance of someone like yourself?
I think any time you think it's affecting your child or it's affecting the family. That's it. I would just use that as your gauge. You've tried a bunch of things. It's not working. You have some concerns. There's no question that parents should be bringing up these questions to their child's doctor and then possibly seeing a specialist if they really need that.
Yeah, and turning to a resource like Sleeping Through the Night.
Right. Again, you can get lots of information that's available and out there and learn about sleep.
Yeah. Are some babies and children predisposed to sleep problems?
Oh, I truly think so. I really joke about it, but I really think they come as sleepers and non-sleepers. And the sleepers, you can do almost anything to. You can rock them to sleep, nurse them to sleep, and they're going to be great sleepers. And the non-sleepers are so sensitive to kind of what's going on. And that's sort of their vulnerability. So when they get stressed, preschool starts or they have a problem in school, the sleep is what falls apart. I think just like, there's some kids who are prone to biting, and there's some kids who are prone to feeling anxious, there's some kids who are prone to having sleep problems.
Yeah. There's a point in the book where you say, I think it's titled, in a chapter, it's titled Warning. There are going to be points through the lifetime of the childhood of your child where sleep is going to get disturbed, and you're going to have to adjust once again. And it could be, like you mentioned, we're starting a new phase of life. We're going to preschool or we're going to school or we're going to go on a vacation, that kind of thing. We're going to move.
Right. Yeah, even the greatest sleeper is going to have some point in time of some issue. Again, it's being sick, it's moving, it's starting school, it's whatever. Sleep is, if you think of it, is a very unusual state. It's a biological state. But we have some control over it, and kind of our thoughts and our behaviors and our environment all affect it. So it's something we have control over and we don't have control over. And so there's so many things that can make it kind of vulnerable.
Yeah. So on the one hand, you're worried, but on the other hand, there are some things you can do, and it's part of life and kind of comes with the territory.
Right. And, you really see it in parents. And I don't know how to quantify it, and I would love to be able to, but once you have sort of a 6-year-old, an 8-year-old, a 15-year-old, you also realize that certain things are phases. Something happens for 2 or 3 nights and you're just like, okay, or 2 or 3 days or whatever, things are going to be fine. When some reason in the first year of life, anything that happens with a baby, you're sure it's forever. And it has been forever and it will be forever. And I don't know what it is. It's sort of a weird sense of time for parents. I'll get a frantic call about, all right, the last 2 days he didn't take his morning nap. He's never going to take his morning nap again. No, it's 2 days, give it time.
Yeah.
And so there is this really kind of strange sense of time that we have with infants.
Yeah. Well, tell us about, maybe here would be a good point to talk about the colicky baby, and you tell a little story, an anecdote in the book about a little guy named Calvin. Oh my gosh. He was a sleeper, and then he hit a certain number of months of age, and one afternoon at 4 o'clock,
that's
boom.
That's it. Colic. Oh, it just, you know, you have this quiet, sweet little baby most of the time. And then usually the colic comes on, it lasts from 3 weeks to 3 months. Usually is the rule of three. It's crying for 3 hours a day for at least three times a week for 3 weeks. And it's just 3 weeks to 3 months. And colic, we don't really know why babies have colic or what causes colic. I mean, there's some babies where it seems to be a tummy problem. They have a hard time digesting and they have reflux and all of those things. Other babies, we just think maybe it's neurological. They kind of just have to grow up. But it's very difficult on parents. And during that period of time, you just need to seek help, get other people to take the baby and take some shifts and really get through it while they, you know, kind of work this out. And try to sort of do everything you can. You know, parents could go to pretty far extremes. I know one mom who the only thing that would quiet her baby down was if she walked up and down the stairs. It was called it her baby stairmaster. You know, so you need to really sort of hang in there. At some point, though, what I think also gets a little bit fuzzy for parents is when's the colic gone and when is it now? It's sort of a bad habit, and that your baby's fallen into the habit of needing you to go up and down the stairs to ever settle down. And so, you know, there's this time where you really need to be talking to your doctor about how they're doing and looking at them and kind of in general to help you sort that out.
Yeah, 3 weeks to 3 months, that's
a long time.
That's a long time to get through that.
It's a long time. Yeah. That's one of those times where it does feel like forever.
Yeah. Jody Mindell is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's a pediatric sleep expert. Her book, Sleeping Through the Night, How Infants, Toddlers, and Their Parents Can Get a Good Night's Sleep. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions about children and sleep. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, let's talk a little bit about sleep and our need for sleep. What's the sleep need of an infant, and how does sleep develop in an infant, if you know what I'm getting at here? Yeah,
right, I know what you mean. Well, in the newborn period, so newborns are sleeping somewhere between 16 and 20 hours a day, which sounds like an extremely high number, but it's always in these small chunks, and it's around the clock. So there's sort of no difference between night and day, and that's why parents really have a very difficult time in those first few months while that sort of sorts out. At around 8 to 12 weeks, you get this real reorganization in sleep where you start to see longer stretches of sleep. You start to see most of the sleep occurring at night. And you really have to, parents have to hang in there to get to that point. You know, at 3 weeks and 4 weeks, there's not much that you can do other than maybe turning a night owl into a daytime baby. So there's this sort of interesting period of time where sleep is sort of all over the place. And then around 8 to 12 weeks, you really start seeing some very solid sleep. You start seeing a pattern to it. At around 3 months, babies are taking anywhere from 2 to 4 naps, and that's going to continue for the first about 9 months. And I think parents would need to understand a lot more sometimes about naps than they do nighttime sleep, because I get so many questions about it. And what's one of the things that I added to the new edition of the book was I thought it was really important to add a chapter on napping and what does napping look like and what's normal and how do you get a napper. But there's many babies between 3 and 9 months who take a nap, a 45-minute nap several times a day. And to them, that's what their body needs, and that's what their body needs to do. And so there's not always this sort of stereotyped long morning nap and long afternoon nap. It's that a lot of babies take several shorter naps throughout the day, and they're totally fine with that. Around 9 months, most babies switch to 2 naps. Between 3 and 12 months, most babies are sleeping a total of about 14 or 15 hours a day. Now, the other thing is there was a really nice research article that came out a couple of years ago that was a European study. What they did was they collected data on a huge number of children and then followed them for about 18 years on how much sleep they were getting. And what you really see, especially in the first year of life, so 0 months to 12 months, these incredible individual differences. And so that, and that narrows down. So by the age of 3 or 4, there's not as much difference between your child and your neighbor's child and your friend's child in terms of how much sleep they need. But in that first year, it's all over the place. And so parents have to be careful when they see these charts that people like me create. It's guidelines, and that some babies are much more and some babies are much less. And it seems to be there's no predictability about why one baby needs a lot more sleep than another baby.
Yeah. Now, how is the sleep spaced through the day for toddlers?
So toddlers, once you start now moving into toddlerhood, so we usually say toddler begins at 12 months, that by 18 months, most toddlers have given up their morning nap, and so they really switch to one longer nap. And what happens is every time they start, you sort of drop a nap, the sleep gets longer, you know, so it all kind of comes together. So if your child was taking 2 1-hour naps, they may switch to one afternoon nap that's almost 2 hours, sometimes an hour and a half, but are 2 hours. There are some children, though, who still need two naps a day until 20 months or 21 months. So, again, you got to really go by your child and not just go by your neighbor's child. One thing that I do see happen a lot is that children who are in daycare, they often move them into the, quote, toddler room at 12 months of age. And to most toddler rooms only have one nap. So there's some babies who aren't ready for that. And so parents kind of have to help manage that. And very often what you can do for a toddler who's in a toddler room with only one nap is the days that they're home, you give them two naps and they catch back up. So babies can switch off as long as you're consistent in one place or the other. So if home is always two naps and daycare is always one nap, that works really well. And then most children start giving up their naps. About 25% give it up by the age of 3, another 50% by the age of 4, and then there's this last 25% who just keep napping. And again, that's fine. The only time it's a difficulty is if they get signed up for afternoon kindergarten. But if your child still needs a nap, you know, that's really important, and you shouldn't take it away too early.
Yeah. I think my mother signed me up for afternoon kindergarten because I got to that age and I was resisting.
Oh, so the nap. Get you out of the house.
So, afternoon
you were tired
kindergarten.
And cranky, let the teacher deal with it.
Yeah. So, and in kindergarten, they had us, you know, settle down for a little, quote, nap.
Right. And they still do. Most kindergarten programs still have a nap time built in. And I think that's really important. Kids in kindergarten, you know, there's a really high demands on these little guys, and they can't sustain it all day. And so having a nap is really important. There's been some school districts recently that have started talking about taking away naps in kindergarten, and also especially in like Head Start programs and daycare, trying to shove more academics in. But it doesn't work. It will backfire because now you're going to get this tired, cranky kid who can never pay attention versus one that you give them some downtime and then they can sort of revive. And even just sort of quiet time can be reviving for a child or for an adult, for that matter.
What if your child is resisting naps and you think they need more sleep than just what they're getting at nighttime?
You know, a lot of times when you're working with or dealing with a toddler or a preschooler, it's all in the presentation. So, you know, you got to do a really good spin. So what happens is they often decide that, quote, naps are for babies, you know. So what you tell them is that now that you're a big girl, you get to have rest time. And rest time means that you get to sit on your bed and you get to, like, look at books. And you'll find out, you know, and you have to do it for an hour, and you can even set a timer for an hour, is that if your child still needs a nap, they're going to conk out. And if they don't need a nap, so then they have, you know, an hour of quiet activities, and you have an hour to recharge yourself. So a lot of time, again, it's this whole thing in the presentation. One thing that I very often recommend to, a little off subject, but to parents of toddlers is putting crib tents on cribs for the little climbers who try to climb out. You know, again, it's all in the presentation. You tell them, look at this really cool thing that big kids get to have. They get to have tents. You know, that's not for babies. And they'll buy it. So you just got to think about how to present it.
Let's go camping.
That's right. Here you go. And if you can bribe like your 5-year-old to also say, I wish I had one, that's it. You know, the 3-year-old's going to go for it, or the 2-year-old.
Yeah. You include a chapter in the book on managing behavior. And maybe you could share some tips from that chapter with us. Because I think it goes to, it all depends how you present it. You got to put a positive spin on it. That's one part of the puzzle.
Yeah, you know, and one of the reasons I included that chapter was also for parents to understand that sleep is a behavior just like biting is, or, you know, having table manners, or, you know, learning to do certain things, and that sleep can be thought of as a behavior and one that you can, you know, help along or not help along. But in general, what you really want to think about with children is that we find that positives go so much farther than negative. So reinforcing your child, doing, telling them what they're doing well, and helping them to understand what's right and what's appropriate, it does so much better than punishment. So telling your, spanking children, yelling at children, telling children no, which all we need to do in our lives a little bit, not the spanking, but telling them no, that's not going to help as much in the long term. So what you want to do is really teach your child the right thing rather than constantly going after the wrong thing. In terms of, what do you do if you're, so I always think about, trying to increase appropriate behavior and trying to decrease inappropriate behavior. So increasing appropriate behavior, telling them yes, telling them good, giving your child lots and lots of attention for they're doing the right thing. On the other side, you want to try as much as you can to ignore the bad stuff. Now, obviously, if they're about to do something, they're going to hurt themselves or someone else, you've got to intervene. But really ignoring it does very, very well, and it sometimes takes a little bit of effort. I just worked with a family where their child would vomit every time he didn't get his way. And so always, and it got to the point it wasn't just at bedtime, but it was in the car. It was in the car seat. It was wherever. And the mom sort of had lost perspective that this was really attention-seeking, and so one day she decided she was going to completely ignore it. And she could see the puzzled look in her son's face in the back seat when he was in the car seat. He just couldn't understand that she wasn't responding, and so she very nonchalantly threw him a towel and said, clean yourself up. We'll be there in a few minutes. And it went away immediately.
Wow.
So, it's very hard to do that, but but that really works. Another thing that can be very effective, and we don't use it around sleep very much, but we use it for other types of kind of bad behaviors, hitting somebody, is time out, where you have your child go sit in a naughty chair or in a timeout chair for a few moments to kind of get themselves collected, get used to collected. And again, that can be very effective. Kids, if you ever notice, a child gets put in timeout, they're so horrified by it. But if you really think about the reality, they're just sitting in a chair, but they just get really upset about it.
Yeah.
And so it usually helps tremendously.
Back to the attention-getting behavior, you can reinforce bad behavior.
Very quickly.
Yeah.
Unbelievably quickly, like vomiting in your child. The kids do it pretty quickly. Other things, and we've all been in that situation, we've all seen that situation, is the, the typical in the grocery store child melting down, wanting a candy bar. And, finally you just say, fine, just so you're not having 50 people looking at you. And what it's just taught your child to do is to scream for a really long time and to really ratchet it up.
Yeah. Another piece of advice you offer is not to ask questions when you intend to give a direction in the instruction, a command. It's not, shall we pick up our toys? No, it's, let's pick up the toys.
Right, exactly. Because if you ask a question like, are you ready to go to bed now? They say no. And now what do you do? So, you need to always make sure that you make it a statement. And you can give your child choices. And I think especially when you're moving on to the later toddler and the preschool years, that giving a choice is a great thing. Do you want to march up the stairs or do you want to tiptoe up the stairs to go to bed? And that way, you're giving them something that they have control over, but you're still heading them in the right direction.
Yeah. Do children, like adults, sleep in cycles?
Yes, they do. We do have, in adults, we have two major kinds of sleep. One's called non-REM sleep, just because it's not REM, and then the other is REM sleep, which is rapid eye movement sleep, when most of our dreams occur. And you can tell someone is in REM sleep. You'll see their eyes darting back and forth behind their eyelids. It's interesting. In adults, about 25% of the night is spent in REM sleep and dreaming sleep. It's interesting, in newborns, they spend 50% of their time in a very similar kind of sleep, which we don't know what that means. It must mean that REM is important for something in development. The other thing that happens during the night in adults and in children is that we go through sleep cycles where we have a period of non-REM sleep and then a period of REM sleep, and that continues, repeats throughout the whole night. And the REM part of it keeps increasing, so in the first REM cycle of sleep, REM may only occur for a few minutes, and by the end of the night, it's occurring for 10 or 15 or 20 minutes. So that's why most of our dreaming occurs, 4, 5, 6 o'clock in the morning, and while you're often are dreaming if you're alone, when your alarm clock goes off. The other thing that happens is at the end of every one of those cycles is you get an arousal, and so that's very often when babies wake up, and why parents can say, he always wakes up at 1 in the morning, because that's right when his sleep cycle ends. And so it is interesting how that you have to understand these concepts about sleep to then lay on it sort of the sleep problems that happen. Like nightmares typically happen in the second half of the night. Sleepwalking, which occurs in a very specific stage of sleep, typically happens in the first part of the night because that's just when the time occurs.
Yeah. Well, all of us can have a nightmare that scares the heck out of you, and all of us wake up. And you point out all babies wake up during the night, but do you say by the age of 6 months, self-soothers can return to sleep on their own while signalers need help to fall back to sleep? Can you encourage self-soothing?
Absolutely. And I think you hit on sort of the whole key to infant sleep. And it's, you know, one of these things that we're sort of always trying to get the message out about, which is that all babies wake up throughout the night. That's normal. All babies should wake up throughout the night, same as all adults wake up throughout the night. We just sort of aren't aware of it. And so we always ask the question of when a baby, you know, is not, quote, sleeping through the night, which is not why are they waking up, but why can't they put themselves back to sleep? So we divide them into the two groups, which is the self-soothers are the ones who wake up during the night and soothe themselves right back to sleep, and you never hear from them. You may hear a squeak or a room roll over or something like that. The signalers are the ones who need help to go back to sleep. And so we always look at what happens at bedtime. So if you're a baby who is, if a baby is rocked to sleep at bedtime, they're going to be rocked to sleep, back to sleep at 1 a.m., 3 a.m., and 5 a.m. They're nursed to sleep at bedtime. They're going to need to be nursed back to sleep every single time they wake up. So whatever you do in the first part of the night is going to make it so it has to happen again later in the night and the next night and probably a month from now and 6 months from now. So you really want to start developing very good sleep habits, which is we really want to encourage these babies to be self-soothers so that they can, you put them down wherever they're going to be sleeping. You know, hopefully it's a, you know, it's a safe place without comforters and pillows and things like that, and that they can put themselves to sleep. And therefore, in the middle of the night, they have a normal arousal and they just normally go right back to sleep on their own. You know, some interesting poll data from the National Sleep Foundation found that, obviously, we're not doing a very good job of making the message out there, that 52% of parents, so most parents, are with their child when they're falling asleep at night. And those children are getting 1 hour less sleep at night and are waking more often at night. So what we think of as this very nice parenting practice may be hurting our children a bit in the long run.
Yeah. So how do you begin to think about what you're willing to do and what you can do? Because there's a lot that is involved in getting good sleep habits established.
Yeah, well, you know, my dream and my hope is that parents will start at a very young age. You know, all the parents out there who are listening who have newborns, you know, at 8, 10, 12 weeks is really start instilling these good sleep habits. Because if you start putting a 9-week-old down awake to fall asleep, we say talk about putting them down drowsy but awake, that a large percentage of them, not all of them, but a large percentage of them will just drift off to sleep on their own, and that's it. You're done. And you just keep putting them down awake, and they're just going to become great sleepers.
Yeah.
Now then you've got the 10-month-old or the 2-year-old who has never slept through the night, and the parents haven't, you know, the child can't soothe themselves to sleep. Well, what do you do? You know, sort of the quick and dirty approach, which is that you do three things always. You have a set bedtime. It's really important to set your child's internal clock, and so you want to put them to bed the same time every night. The second thing is you want a bedtime routine, 20 to 30 minutes, soothing activities that are really an enjoyable kind of quality family time. The third thing is having them fall asleep on their own, and that's the hard part. Again, the quick and dirty approach is you put them down in their crib or their bed, and you leave the room, and you just keep checking on them and check on them and check on them and check on them. You're going to be coming in and out as often as you want or as, you know, frequently or as infrequently as you want. Some parents, you know, can only tolerate being out of the room for 30 seconds, and that's totally fine. And there's some children who get so upset when their parents check on them that it's not worth doing it, and so you check on them infrequently. The first night takes about 45 minutes. The second night, about an hour. It always gets worse before it gets better. The third night, if you stick with it, in most children, you're down to 20 minutes, and then you're golden after that. So it doesn't take very long. I also very strongly recommend that parents only focus on bedtime at first because you're teaching a skill. And what happens is that most babies and most toddlers, that once they're falling asleep easily and quickly at bedtime on their own, it will just start sleeping through the night in about 2 weeks. So that way, in the middle of the night, you can always go to your baby. You can always do whatever you want to get yourself and your child back to sleep.
Yeah. This was really good advice, I think. Head in one direction.
I know. I'm known for that, too, and it's one of those things. Bedtime routines. Oh, we see families, and this is their bedtime routine. I'm sure some people are going to say, it sounds just like mine. So they go, you know, 7 o'clock comes, and they go upstairs for a bath, and they come back downstairs for the kitchen for a snack, and then they go in the family room to watch a video, and then they go to the parents' room for a story, and then they head to the child's room. And they can't understand why every transition things aren't working very well. So all you want to do is instead, you know, do your evening activities, whatever they're going to be, you know, say 7:30 then. 7:30 up for bath, straight to the child's room, pajamas, stories, to bed. Because you just want to keep heading in the right direction and not going backwards. Yeah. It's going to save a huge amount of bedtime strife and a huge amount of sort of corralling. You know, all parents know that feeling of trying to convince a child to go upstairs. Well, doing that three times doesn't help at all. And also sort of running around after the naked child who just got out of the bathtub. Again, if you can head them in the right direction, that's a great way to go.
From the bathroom to the bedroom.
That's right. Just one step. That's it.
Are we going to tiptoe down to the bedroom?
Right.
Or are we going to hop down to the bedroom?
Exactly. The other thing is, especially with toddlers and preschoolers, is to put in place the very last thing of your bedtime routine is an absolutely favorite thing of your child. So, another family that I worked with, bedtime was a battle. It was a 2.5-year-old boy. It was a complete battle. They couldn't get him from bath to his room. It's just, you know, a mess. And they finally built into their bedtime routine that the last 5 minutes before lights got turned out, in his bed, he got to play G.I. Joe's with his dad. And that solved everything. Because he wasn't sort of fighting them. All he wanted to do was get to play with his dad. So he would take his bath, have fun in the bath, and then he'd do teeth, pajamas, and right into bed. It doesn't have to be sort of the traditional, you know, you always have to read two stories at bedtime. I mean, obviously reading at bedtime is a very good thing. But if that's not going to get your child there, you know, G.I. Joe's are just as good.
Right. Jody Mindell is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's an expert on pediatric sleep. She's the author of Sleeping Through the Night, How Infants, Toddlers, and Their Parents Can Get a Good Night's Sleep. Our guest is Associate Director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. She's a professor of psychology at St. Joseph's University and of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. Her book, Sleeping Through the Night, available in paperback from Harper Resource. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. What if you have a child, for some reason or another, has suddenly become fearful about lights out, time to go to bed?
Yeah, you know, nighttime fears are very common. They're almost universal in preschoolers, that at some point, and parents, you know, you need to understand that that's normal development, is that your child becoming fearful is part of their kind of developing imagination. Is, you know, 1 or 1.5 year old doesn't understand that there's things that can hurt them or are scary. But when you get to be closer to 2.5 and 3, all of a sudden your imagination develops, and you're sure there's monsters in the closet, and you're sure there's things under your bed, and you're sure. And they're all unrealistic. It's very, you know, so you, as a parent, are trying to convince them that what they're scared of isn't real and what they should be scared of is real. You know, stepping out off the curb in front of a truck is a bad thing, but kids aren't scared of that. So these nighttime fears are very common. And there's a lot of things that you can do, especially if your child is something like afraid of the dark or anything like that. And you can't, the reality check is a good thing, but it doesn't get you far. So telling your child they're not real, you need to do that because you need to teach them they're not real. But that will not convince a 3-year-old in any way that monster is not going to get them. So, you know, you need to use sort of imaginary things or imaginative things. We use a lot of what we call monster spray, where we take a spray bottle and you pour water in it and you put a little, you know, you put a little label on it, says monster spray, and you spray the monsters away. If your child is afraid of the dark, we do a lot of things of playing, like playing flashlight tag or turning out the lights and looking for glow-in-the-dark items. And so you get your child to have a positive experience with the dark rather than a negative experience with the dark. Even some simple things like, you know, a fishbowl with a fish in it in your child's room is going to make them feel better. If your child has a transitional object, a lovey, you know, a teddy bear, a blankie, or whatever, you know, that quote protects children, you know. So you want to really do things to help them feel comfortable and understand that as you're doing this, you're really teaching your child coping skills, which is a really good thing for when they are scared, and that they have things that they can kind of rely on, obviously not monster spray, but, you know, when they start preschool or they, you know, something is kind of scary happening, that they may have a lovey with them or they may have ways to save themselves. This isn't scary. This is really fun instead, to help them get through those situations.
Let's talk with a listener. Caller on line 1. Good afternoon.
Hi, this is a caller from Champaign.
Uh-huh.
Hi, I have a... Hello?
Go ahead, we can hear you.
Oh, okay, I have a comment and a question. Our bedtime routine, the last thing that we do with our daughter is we tell a bedtime story, and the focus of it is her. I say, once upon a time, there was a little girl named, and then I say her name, and then we go through everything that we did during the day, and it's also a great time to talk about good behaviors and bad behaviors, and she loves it because it's all about her.
That's a great idea. I also like teaching about good and bad behavior. That's great.
Yeah, and she really enjoys that. And then I say, and then we read a bedtime story, and then Mommy told her a story, and then she went to bed. And then she's great with that. I definitely don't have a self-soother kind of baby. Lately, this is my question. She's been waking up right around 2 o'clock in the morning and climbing into our bed.
And how old is she?
She's 3 and a half.
Okay. And is she in a bed?
Pardon me?
Is she in a bed?
She is in a bed.
Okay, and are you with her when she falls asleep at bedtime?
No. We tell the bedtime story, she goes to sleep, but then she goes to bed between 8:30 and 9 o'clock very consistently, but almost, you know, I would say 90% of the time she wakes up in the middle of the night and she ends up in our bed.
You're 75% of the way there. Her being able to fall asleep on her own at bedtime means she's really close.
Okay.
So at 3 and a half, I do a couple of things. One is you have to decide when you're going to start, and you have to return her every single time she comes in. And one of the downfalls for parents is that very often they sleep through it, you know, all of a sudden they see this little body.
That's exactly what happened.
And so what you want to do is do something like, we often do something simple, like hang a bell on your doorknob, and so she wakes you when she comes in.
Okay.
The other thing that I would do with her is I would set up a sticker chart. She gets a sticker every morning for having slept in her own bed all night long. Now, whether or not that she came in 10 times is you want to start with something you know she can do, which is sleep in her bed all night long. So even if you return her 10 times, she still gets her sticker. And then what you can do is after she's had success at that for a week or so, is then she can start getting stickers for just staying in her bed all night.
Okay.
And you're going to find that very quickly you can turn this around, but you got to be really consistent.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Sure. Good luck.
Okay. Have a great night.
Thanks for that. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Jody Mindell, our guest this afternoon, sleeping through the night, our topic, how infants, toddlers, and their parents can get a good night's sleep.
Sticker charts. Let me talk a little bit more about sticker charts.
Okay.
Sticker charts are great. Again, kids, will 3 or 4 year olds, will do almost anything for a sticker, and it's a really nice way for them not just to get a sticker, but it's more about getting their parents' praise and getting really positive things. Now, you have to be pretty careful. There are some downfalls to stickers, which is sometimes parents set up things like the child gets a toy if they get 10 stickers. For a 3 year old, 10 stickers is literally impossible, and so they feel like they're a failure all the time.
Mm.
So what we often do is that if you get 1 sticker or 2 stickers, you can turn it in for a prize. And a prize doesn't have to be something you buy. A prize can be going to the library and getting a video, or going on a bike ride with your mom or your dad, or making chocolate chip cookies, or getting to pick what's for dinner that night. So parents can do some really nice family things for getting these stickers. And the other thing is, when you want to sort of start upping the ante, which is making it a little bit harder, is that you don't want to say to them you have to get 4 stickers in a row. Because on the third night, when things fall apart, they're back at zero. So you want to say when you get a total of 4 stickers. But you got to really make it in a time frame that's appropriate for kids. And you also don't want to set them up in other ways. And, for example, we once had a family where the child was going to be able to win some award, which was going to be his Hanukkah present, which, again, those should be totally separate. Hanukkah presents or Christmas presents or Easter presents or should be just presents. But this is having your child work for something that is separate and is individual and is, you know, not tied to kind of a family traditional event.
Okay, let's talk with another listener. I'll call her on line one. Good afternoon.
Hello. I've tuned in and out, so I haven't heard all that you've been saying, and you may have addressed this. I've really enjoyed what I have been hearing. But I did have a comment, and that is I hadn't yet heard anyone talk about co-sleeping, and I don't know if that's come up yet. But I do think it's important for people to be aware that co-sleeping, from the anthropological and historical evidence that we have, and I am an anthropologist and I've done research on this, co-sleeping looks like it's probably been the norm for most humans, for most of recorded human history. And it all the callers I've heard about, and the responses seem to be oriented around the notion that getting a child to sleep in a separate space far away from the parent is a universal goal, and that's just not the way it is. It is a very common goal in America, and it does fit in with a lot of cultural values that we have favoring independence. But in many, many other societies, probably most, for most of human history, socializing children to feel that they're part of a community is actually more important to socializing them to feel that it's important to be independent. And there is a growing, small but interesting growing movement of co-sleepers in America. And for listeners who are considering it, I think it's important for them to be encouraged that it's not universally wrong. It's sort of locally wrong.
No, I totally agree. There's no question about it. And one of the things I did with the new edition of Sleeping Through the Night was to add a chapter on co-sleeping to help parents make that choice. And I think for every family, it needs to be a choice. And we know there's a lot of lifestyle co-sleeping out there. For example, the caller who had the 3.5-year-old, that was more of a reactive co-sleeping, which is sounds like they preferred their child to be spending the night in her own bed rather than coming to the parents' bed. And I think this issue is going to really come to a head over the next probably quite soon, and I don't know if you've heard about it, but New York City is proclaiming this safety campaign, which is really anti-co-sleeping, which of all places in our country is probably the largest immigration group. I mean, I don't know that by fact, but I would suspect that. And so this is going to backfire, I think, for New York City, and I think they're trying to do something good in their safety campaign of 10 different issues, but this is not the issue to pick. And I think the pediatric sleep community is really rallying around talking about that culturally co-sleeping is appropriate for many people as long as they do it safely. And that's the bigger concern is the safety of it. But I agree with you that co-sleeping is a choice for families and a choice they need to make for themselves.
And let's see if we can get one more call in this afternoon before we're out of time in Chicago. Line 4, good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, yeah, I have a question for you. We have a 7-week-old, and you had said on the program, I think you can start trying to reinforce good sleeping habits at around 8 weeks in terms of soothing themselves to sleep. How do you handle when the baby cries at this young age, and how long do you go before you should worry about not trying to go to her right away when she does cry?
At 7 weeks, you know, it's a really good time to start thinking about developing good sleep habits. And what I always say for the sort of 7 weeks to 12 weeks or so is to just give them chances. So I don't know if it's do you have a daughter or a son?
A daughter.
A daughter. So what you want to do with her is you want to try putting her down, you know, give her a minute or two. If she's fussing, just go get her. And that's it. And try again later or try again the next day or try again a week from now. But what you want to do is give her the opportunity because I'd say half the time you'll be surprised. She'll be totally fine.
Okay. And how long would you use then longer periods before you'd go and pick her up when she's crying? How old would she need to be?
I would probably wait till at least she's 10 or 12 weeks.
Before you start doing that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I would wait. And even at 10 weeks is a bit early. You know, maybe you want to wait 3 minutes then and see if she settles herself down.
And then start
But not
up.
Until at least 12 weeks would you really expect that when she gets upset that she can settle herself down.
Okay.
Okay. Good luck with
her. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks for the call. And we've got one more listener coming in here, and I think we can squeeze this caller in here this afternoon on line one. Hello? Hello? Nope.
Oh, you've lost your listener.
Yep, we lost a listener. Well, we're here. We've got to wrap up now. And this happens occasionally. You have this great topic, and we get going, and then we get all the listeners excited.
Right.
And they call in. And then we're out of time. So, and I understand you've got a book coming out in the fall about adolescence.
It's going to be co-authored with my colleague Judith Owens at Brown University, and it's on sleep in preschoolers through high schoolers.
Oh.
So really covering the school-age children and the adolescents and how to deal with all of those issues that come along with that age group. Because at this point, most of the parenting education is all for the under three set. And really realize that there's this incredible need out there and how to help children of all ages sleep.
Very good. Well, I hope we'll talk again then.
That'd be great.
Okay. Jody, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, thank you.
Jody Mindell has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of Sleeping Through the Night, How Infants, Toddlers, and Their Parents Can Get a Good Night's Sleep. The book is published is available in paperback in a revised edition from Harper Resource, an imprint of HarperCollins. 10 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade on this Tuesday afternoon, futures in the corn pit were about a half higher in the nearbys. The deferreds, far deferreds, were down a quarter. Soy complex, nearby is down about 3 cents, but the deferreds were up a penny and a half. We'll talk with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities out of Newmarket, Indiana, about that particular action at the Chicago Board of Trade. See why it happened a little bit later in the afternoon, about 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock, roughly 15 minutes away at this point. In the wheat pit for the Board of Trade now, soft red winter wheat traded the May contract to a high price today of $3.13, the low there at $3.07.5, and a settlement price at $3.12.5. It finished 7 higher. And July futures now, $3.23, the high, the low at $3.15, and a settlement price at $3.21.5. They were up 8. And September contract in the wheat pit for the day, a $3.32 high, low at $3.24, and a settlement price there at $3.31.5, up 8.25. December contract at $3.42.5, high, low at $3.33, settlement price at $3.39.75, up 8. And December wheat up 10 cents for the day, $3.51, the high, the low at $3.45, settlement price at $3.50. From the corn pit, $2.01.5, the high for the day, the low at $1.99.75, settled at $2.25. They were up a half. July futures up a half as well, $2.09.75, the high in the corn pit, the low at $2.07.5, and July corn settled $2.08.25. They were up one half for the day. September contract $2.17.75, the high, the low at $2.15.75. Settlement there at $2.16.25, up a half. And December contract in the corn pit, $2.27.75, the high, the low at $2.25.5, settled there at $2.25.75. They were unchanged. March contract at $2.35.5, high, low at $2.33.5, settled $2.33.75, up a quarter. And the May corn finished down a quarter of a cent, $2.40, the high, the low at $2.38, settlement price at $2.38. Hey, I know you're out there planting corn or possibly planting beans at this point, but when you get into the field tonight and get a chance to get on your computer, you should log into the website for WILL Agriculture at will.uiuc.edu. Click on AM and then Agriculture. You're going to want to subscribe to our email newsletter. Comes out usually on the weekends. This past weekend for Commodity Week, as you probably know, we talked with Joe Victor of Allendale. You can listen to that off of the website, but if you get in the email and you subscribe, I'll send you this past weekend's newsletter, and it has a segment called After the Bell, which includes about 20 minutes on ethanol and other topics on corn I think you'll find very interesting. Easy to do. Just hit our website at will.uiuc.edu. Click on AM and then Agriculture. May oats for the day from the Chicago Board of Trade now for the settlement prices. $1.32 the high, the low at $1.31, settled on that low, down 2 cents. July off a nickel, $1.39 the high, the low at $1.33, and a settlement price there at $1.33.25. From the soy complex, May beans, $6.37 the high, the low at $6.28, settled $6.28.25, down 3.75. July futures, $6.43.75 the high, the low at $6.33. Settlement price at $6.34. They were down 3.75 for the day. August contract, $6.42.5 the high, the low at $6.33. Settlement price at $6.34, down 2.5 for the day. And September's, $6.38 the high, the low at $6.29. Settled $6.29.5. They were up a half of the day. November soybeans, up 1.5, $6.36 the high, the low at $28, settled a penny above that low at $6.29 a bushel for the Novembers. They were a penny and one half higher. January futures now, $6.38 the high, the low at $6.30.5, settlement price there at $6.30.5. They were up 1, and the March contract up a half cent on the day, $6.37 the high, the low at $6.30, and the settlement price at $6.30 for the March soybeans as well, and they were up a half. One other thing for this week, don't forget to tune in Thursday afternoon for the whole closing market report. Celeste Quinn has graciously allowed us to take the whole 2 to 3 o'clock hour for all of the month of April on Thursday and 3 Thursdays in May, and we take up the topic of Farm Bill 2007, a bit ahead of the curve, but now it's starting to make its way through Washington, D.C. You saw Secretary of Agriculture Johans talking about the Farm Bill last week. We'll hear more in the Ag News segment later today about that during the closing market report. But you can tune in this Thursday, and we'll take a look at Farm Bill policy potentials from the left-hand side with the Family Farm Coalition, along with Daryl Ray, who is a professor of agricultural policy at the University of Tennessee. That happens this Thursday during the closing market report. Bean meal from the Board of Trade, 195.80 the high, the low at 193.20 for the May. Settlement price up 40 at 194.50. July bean meal, 195 the high, the low at 192.30. Settlement there at 193.50. They were up 60 for the day. Bean oil now 23.60 the high, the low at $23.22. Settled on that low, down 28. And July oil off 30, 23.26 the settlement price. Had a high of 23.70 and a low at 23.25. And once again, that July bean oil settled 23.26. It was down 30 for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. May feeder cattle, the high 111.40, the low 111 even, the settlement 111.35, that up 27 and a half. August, 110.90, the high, 110.10, the low, 110.82 and a half, the settlement, that up 77 and a half. September, 110 even, the high, 108.95, the low, 109.87 and a half, the settlement, that up 87 and a half. June live cattle, 86.20, the high, 85.35, the low, 86.10, the settlement, that finishing up 70. August live cattle, 86.35, the high, 85.75, the low, 86.05, the settlement, that down 10. May lean hogs, 77.20, the high, the low, 76.40, the settlement, 76.75, that down 82.5. June, 75.40, the high, 74.55, the low, 75.30, the settlement, that finishing up 17.5. July, 75.70, the high, 74.90, the low, 75.07.5, the settlement, that down 70. August, 74.70, the high, 73.85, the low, the settlement, 73.95, that down 90. And May bellies, 80.92.5, the high, $80.05. The low price, the settlement, 80.77 and a half, that down 40. And let's take a look now at the Dow. It is down 110 points at 10,274. The S&P 500 off 13 points at 1166. Excuse me.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Sammy Ario from Tampere, Finland writes, Dear Dr. Science, I sold my soul last week, but now I'm having regrets. Could I weasel out of the deal by lying that I only meant to sell my funky Latin soul?
Well, you could try, but being Finnish will make it even harder to pull off. Of course, the Finns are universally regarded as the Brazilians of Northern Europe. But you should have put more thought into the deal you were making before you signed with blood on the dotted line. What'd you get out of selling your soul anyway? One night with Heather Locklear? All the pizza you could eat? A bottomless pitcher of Mountain Dew? Plead insanity. If that doesn't work, ask the Pope. He gets these kinds of questions all the time.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree.